Good evening. This is the Right Reverend John St. Germain, welcoming you to Crystal Silence League Hour. And tonight we're going to discuss quite a few things. And gosh, you know, welcome back. I'm so glad to see you. I had someone call me on the phone today, and you know, for a consultation. And they this person, she said, I listen to your show every week, and I love it, and thank you guys for the hard work that you do to bring it to us. And, you know, it's not just me, the visible voice of the Crystal Silence League, but everyone in Missionary Independent Spiritual Church and Lucky Mojo Curio Company and LMC Radio Network working very hard behind the scenes to bring you these fine programs. So why don't we take a moment to enjoy our relaxing spiritual interlude here. Grab your crystal balls. Grab a cold drink, grab a warm drink, depending on where you are, and come right back. And we're going to discuss one of the most remarkable men in history, Emperor Ashoka. Do come back. And I am back. We had a very short musical interlude. That's the way we do things here. I'm just anxious to get started. For those of you who don't know our illustrious history, the Crystal Silence League was founded by another remarkable man, Claude Alexander Conlon, around 1917 for the purpose of teaching people the art and science of crystallomancy, of scrying with crystal balls. But not only that, he taught people how to project and attract prosperity, happiness, love, success, through the visualization and projection of crystal ball magic, which we also teach in the Crystal Silence League. He also projected positive affirmation and prayer to all those in need. And you can find us online at www.crystalsilenceleague.org, because when Mr. Conlon passed into the silence around 1954, 6 years before I was born, by the way, Crystal Silence League passed into the silence with him. But spiritual adepts of Missionary Independent Spiritual Church brought it online around 2011, I believe. And it has been running full blast ever since. We get several hundred prayers per week, many of those prayers of which we read online every single week. We don't read them all because we get several hundred of them, but a selection of those I do read aloud, and I invite all of you to read them aloud with me. But before we go to the prayers, we'd like to discuss our crystal of the week, which this week is danbarite. And danbarite, as you can see on our slideshow, is a very pretty stone. It's one of the stones that vibrate at a very high vibration. It can resonate with either the crown or the heart chakra, because depending on how you hold it and how light hits it, it can be found with either clear or with a subtle pink tint. And the same stone can be either clear or pink, believe it or not. And it facilitates communication with angels, archangels, extraterrestrial beings, and even those who dwell in other dimensions. And like all the angel stones, it can do this. It can also aid in spiritual enlightenment by opening the crown chakra during deep meditation. In case you're curious, the list of angel stones, along with danbarite, are angelite, or angelite, celestite, danbarite, galaxite, iolite, labradorite, larimar, morganite, selenite, and seraphinite. You don't have to write that down. You can just Google angel stones, or wait for my upcoming book on crystal magic. It'll be out in May, I believe. We'll be debuting it at the Hoodoo Heritage Festival, May 14th and 15th. You will come. So let's go on with our prayers. And these prayers are always read anonymously. We never identify anybody by name. Although through various psychic means, of course, we know exactly who you are. There is no anonymity in this business. I identify them by a prayer ID only, which is a number. And we shall read these aloud, and please join me in wishing these people the best success and happiness. Prayer ID number 47794, who is praying that the dragons build up a strong connection to this person and that they clear him or her of all evil and witch spirits. I know exactly what he's talking about. He's talking about Nagas. Prayer ID number 47793, which is anonymous, who prays for freedom from his sexual addiction, I believe. He wants to be free from lust, and he wants to be strong, not to give in to lust, and watching internet porn, and he wants to only have desire for his wife. Prayer ID number 47792 wants her business to her online business to expand exponentially. Exponential expansion can make you a millionaire in about a month. And you know that? You take a penny, double it every day, you know, 2 cents the next day, 4 cents the next day, by the end of the month, you're a millionaire. Prayer ID number 47791. Thanks for our prayers. One has come through. And she says, God bless you. Well, thank you. God bless you, too. Prayer ID number 47790, who is someone else, entirely different, who also thanks us for her prayers and says her prayers have been answered too. Prayer ID number 47789, who has some learning problems, learning challenges, and has just a few months before his college degree comes through and college finishes, and he's struggling to find motivation to complete this because of his learning challenges, and prays that he succeeds, and wants us to pray and give him support that he can succeed in his work and finish this very tough challenge that he set for himself. You know, we do pray for your success. Prayer ID number 47788 wants the relationship between him and his partner to improve. Prayer ID number 47787 wants us to pray for his girlfriend, who has an abusive father, who, although he doesn't live with the family, he often drops by unannounced, intoxicated, causing fear and a disruption in their life. Prayer ID number 47786 is working spell work on her boyfriend for reconciliation and peace, and says, please, God, let the spell work. If it's justified work, and it appears to be, may it end in success. Prayer ID number 47785 apparently lost their web page and can't find it, and prays that their web page that they lost will be found or reopened. Computer problem apparently. May that be resolved. Prayer ID number 47784. That's one of the most unusual prayers we've ever got. 47784. Says she has no friends or affiliations, and prays that she seeks and finds some friendly affiliations with friends and people to connect with, collaborate with, and cohabitate with. Prayer ID number 47782 needs blessings to start her own business, find a supplier that will allow her to become successful, and find the best web designer and all the supplies and connections to help her business grow and flourish. We have prayer ID number 47781, also a business entrepreneur. Please bless her to start her own business and find time and a supplier to help her succeed as well. This is very good, very good. And prayer ID number 47777 prays for her and someone named B to speak and to heal their relationship, and she's doing work as well, and doing work with one of our air workers, and prays for the successful outcome of the work they're doing together. Prayer ID number 47776 wants, very basically, get my lover back, and may that come true for you, if it's meant to be. Prayer ID number 47775, our final player says, go bingo, please, if the stars in the sky can hear me now, please allow my husband and I to win money or a jackpot in bingo today. And the date is today. We really need the money. Thank you. So may the jackpot be yours, B24. Amen. May these prayers be solved. May these prayers be resolved. May these issues be answered. May the dreams come true for all sentient beings. You know, God bless them. Let's have a moment of silence and quiet meditation and contemplation for all those in need of comfort, support, succor, and blessings. Tonight, as we segue into the Eightfold Noble Path of the Buddha, is about a person you may or may not have ever heard of, and this is Ashoka the Great, who ruled almost all of the Indian subcontinent from around 268 to 232 before the Common Era. And the reason we're interested in him is because he went from being a bloodthirsty conqueror to being the first person in history and the only person in history to set aside his military and announce to everyone around him that they had nothing to fear from him because he dismantled his military and he planned to live in peace. He also erected throughout Indian Asia the Ashokan edicts. There are these pillars on which are carved his rules of conduct, his rules that he lived by, which were based on the Buddhist precepts, and they stand to this day, and they're remarkable. They are remarkable documents to a man who went from being a conqueror to being a person of great morality. Now, the legends in Buddhism many scholars think tend to exaggerate both his bloodthirstiness and his subsequent piousness, as you know, legends tend to do, but a lot of what we know is that he was a conqueror. He rose to power during the time he was a grandson of a fellow named Chandragupta Maurya, who was a founder of an entire dynasty of rulers. His mother was a queen, his father was a conqueror, he had all kinds of brothers and sisters, and he had half brothers, and everybody they all were conquerors. He rose to power. He was a governor. His rise to power was considered meteoric, and the accounts of his life report him as being bad tempered and of an evil nature. And during his pre-Buddhist rule, he was known. He built a thing called Ashoka's Hell, which was a torture chamber, and to punish criminals. And it was described as a heavenly hell because the contrast between its beautiful exterior and the horrors that were carried out within by his executioners. It earned him the name of Khanda Ashoka, meaning Ashoka the Ferocious. He was kind of like Vlad Dracul of India. But again, some of the legends may have exaggerated his bloodthirstiness, but there was no doubt that he had a pivotal moment in his life, and that was the conquest of Kalinga. Kalinga was a state that was very proud of its sovereignty and democracy. It was a democratic state, and it's it had a parliament. Now, understand, this was 200, 300 BC, and it had a parliament. It had a democratic parliament, and it was an exception in India, where mostly there was a there was rajas. This was intrinsically a caste system. There was the idea of there was a dharma behind it. You know, there was a type of honor behind it. But the you had this idea of divine rule. But so the Kalinga War happened 8 years after Ashoka's coronation as king. And what we know from the 13th Ashoka pillar, we know that this battle was a massive one and a bloody one, and it caused the deaths of over 100,000 soldiers and many civilians who rose up in defense, and more than 150,000 people, Kalingans, were deported. And when he was walking through the grounds of Kalinga after his conquest, rejoicing in his victory, he became devastated by the number of bodies strewn here and there like garbage, and the wails and grievings of the bereaved. And on the rock 13 of the Edicts of Ashoka, the remorse the king felt after this destruction of Kalinga was terrible. Records say, record, it's a famous monologue. It's in all the legends and in all the historical records. He said that after the war was over, he went out to roam the city to feast his eyes on his spoils, and all he could see were burnt houses and scattered corpses, and it made him sick. And he cried out in agony and recited the famous monologue, which was, "What have I done? If this is victory, what's a defeat then? Is this a victory or a defeat? Is this justice or injustice? Is it gallantry or a rout? Is it valor to kill innocent children and women? Did I do it to widen the empire and for prosperity, or to destroy the other's kingdom and splendor? One has lost her husband, someone else a father, someone a child, someone an unborn infant. What's this debris of the corpses? Are these marks of victory or defeat? Are these vultures, crows, eagles, the messengers of death, or evil?" So this terrible war with Kalinga transformed Ashoka the fierce into Ashoka the Buddhist. It transformed him into this stable and peaceful emperor, and he became a patron of Buddhism. Now, whether or not he converted to Buddhism by taking the Triple Gem, it's not recorded. Most Buddhist traditions and scholars say he probably did. And certainly the Kalinga War changed him. Now, the Dharma propagated by Ashoka was not pure Theravadan Buddhism. But the missionaries, the thousands of missionaries that he sent out on the Buddhist diaspora, the Ashokan diaspora, were all Theravadan Buddhists. The curious thing is, I guess, is on the Ashoka columns, the rock edicts, he never records his conversion. He never says, at this moment, I put my faith, I sought refuge in the Dharma, the Triple Gem, the Dharma, the Buddha, the Sangha. And this is why there's some controversy or some discussion about whether or not he actually formally converted to Buddhism. But nonetheless, his patronage led to the expansion of Buddhism throughout the entire world. And I'm not exaggerating by that. Worldwide, from about 250 BCE to probably at least 40 to 50 AD, the diaspora continued. And this straddles the birth and death of Christ in Hellenistic Greece. And I'll read you some documents that came up fairly recently that will raise hair on your head. It did mine. So Ashoka ruled for about 36 years, and during that entire time he sent out Buddhist missionaries or emissaries to every part of the world. In his old age, he sent out another set of edicts. They think he sent out four sets of rock pillars. They are all over India and Asia. And now and again they find another one. They're in caves. They're everywhere. He also went to every spot mentioned in the life of the Buddha and erected columns, and you can still find those. The birthplace of the Buddha, the site of the Enlightenment, everywhere. So he is considered the most exemplary ruler, one of the most exemplary rulers that ever lived. And you know, none of the outlying countries or nations ever invaded his territory. Now, after his death, his sons fought for his territory. Understand, he ruled most of India, a very large continent, and at no time did other nations invade him. And he had no military. None. No military. Now, I've heard certain people, military strategists, say, well, they probably thought that he had no visible military and they were scared of what he had hidden. And but I said, you don't understand what happened here. This was a man who publicly announced, I've set down my weapons and I'm ruling by compassion. And, you know, you guys fight all you want. I'm not going to fight. You know, and if you invade us, you know, more power to you. You fight among yourselves. Now, would that work today? I'm not going to put an opinion. Is there room for a Buddhist ruler today? He also supported every religion. And when I read you the edicts, I'm going to tell you what he has to say on it, Edict 13. And it is the most sensible thing that you've ever... You just shake your head and say, why don't people do this? Ashoka is not a mythical figure. He's not a legendary figure. He's backed up by historical artifacts, not the least of which are the Ashokan columns. And I can tell you more about his life and death and history, but what I want to do is read you the Ashokan, the 14 rock edicts. those are the first ones he put out. Then there are the Kalinga rock edicts, the minor rock edicts, the seven pillar edicts, minor pillar edicts. He put them up all over, but the main ones are the 14 rock edicts. And then we'll talk about the missionaries he sent out. There's a great deal of stuff on the internet, discussion and translations about it, and pictures, the rock edicts. And understand, these things are still exist. You can go and see them. But Rock Edict 1, and I'm going to read you this. Number one, and these are the rules he put him out, and these are the rules that he stood by, these are the rules he ruled his kingdom by. This is basically his constitution. This is what, you know, the Constitution of the United States, this is the constitution of King Ashoka. Number one, beloved of the gods, King Pyadasi has caused this Dharma edict to be written. Here in my domain, no living beings are to be slaughtered or offered in sacrifice, nor should festivals be held. For beloved of the gods, King Pyadasi sees much to object to in such festivals. Now, these festivals, they used to sacrifice in these Vedic festivals, and to this day in India, there are still some of these festivals. They sacrifice hundreds of animals in these festivals. That's what he's talking about, not like, you know, the Hoodoo Heritage Festival, stuff like that. Although there are some festivals that beloved of the gods, King Pyadasi, does approve of. Formerly, in the kitchen of beloved of the gods, King Pyadasi, hundreds of thousands of animals were killed every day to make curry. But now, with the writing of this Dharma edict, only three creatures, two peacocks and a deer, are killed, and the deer not always. And in time, not even these creatures will be killed. Number two, everywhere within beloved of the gods, King Pyadasi's domain, and among the people beyond the borders, the Kolas, the Pyandas, the Sariputras, the Karalupas, as far as, etc., there's a lot of cities here, where the Greek king Antiochus rules, and among the kings who are neighbors of Antiochus, everywhere that has beloved of the gods, King Pyadasi made provision for two types of medical treatment for humans and medical treatment for animals. You understand, this is 300 BC. That was unheard of. Wherever medical herbs suitable for humans or animals are not available, I have had them imported and grown. Wherever medical roots or fruits are not available, I have had them imported and grown. Along roads, I have had wells dug and trees planted for the benefit of humans and animals. Number three, Beloved of the gods, King Payadasi speaks thus. 12 years after my coronation, this is ordered. Everywhere in my domain, the Yuktas, the Rajukas, and the Pradasikas shall go on inspection tours. These are, you know, officials. Every 5 years for the purpose of Dharma instruction and also to conduct other business. Respect for mother and father is good. Generosity to friends, acquaintances, relatives, Brahmins, and ascetics is good. Not killing living beings is good. Moderation in spending and moderation in saving is good. The council shall notify the Yuktas about the observance of these instructions in these very words. And number four, in the past, for many hundreds of years, killing or harming living beings and improper behavior toward relatives and improper behavior toward Brahmins and ascetics has increased. But now, due to Beloved of the Gods, King Payadasi's Dharma practice, the sound of the drum has been replaced by the sound of the Dharma. The sighting of heavenly cars, auspicious elephants, bodies of fire, and other divine sightings has not happened for many hundreds of years. But now, because Beloved of the Gods, King Payadasi, promotes restraint in the killing and harming of living beings, proper behavior toward relatives, Brahmins, and ascetics, and respect for mother, father, and elders, such sightings have increased. These and many other kinds of Dharma practice have been encouraged by Beloved of the Gods, King Payadasi, and he will continue to promote Dharma practice. And the sons, grandsons, and great-grandsons of Beloved of the Gods, too, will continue to promote Dharma practice until the end of time. Living by Dharma and virtue, they will instruct in Dharma. Truly, this is the highest work to instruct in Dharma. But practicing the Dharma cannot be done by one who is devoid of virtue, and therefore its promotion and growth is commendable. Beloved of the Gods, this is number five. Beloved of the Gods speaks thus. To do good is difficult. One who does good first does something hard to do. I have done many good deeds, and if my sons, grandsons, and their descendants up to the end of the world act in like manner, they too will do much good. But whoever among them neglects this, they will do evil. Truly, it is easy to do evil. In the past, there were no Dharma Mahamatras. Those are monks, teachers. But such officers were appointed by me 13 years after my coronation. Now they work among all religions for the establishment of Dharma, for the promotion of Dharma, for the welfare and happiness of all who are devoted to Dharma. They work among the Greeks, the Cambojas, the Gandharas, the Rastrikas, the Papnikas, and other peoples on the western borders. They work among soldiers, chiefs, Brahmins, householders, the poor, the aged, and those devoted to Dharma for their welfare and happiness, so that they may be free from harassment. They, the Dharma Mahamatras, work for the proper treatment of prisoners, toward their unfettering. And if the Mahamatras think, this one has a family to support, that one has been bewitched, that one is old, then they work for the release of such prisoners. They work here, in outlying towns, in the women's quarters belonging to my brothers and sisters, and among my other relatives. They are occupied everywhere. These Dharma Mahamatras are occupied in my domain among people devoted to Dharma to determine who is devoted to Dharma, who is established in Dharma, and who is generous. These Dharma edicts have been written in stone so that it might be endure long and my descendants might act in conformity with it. Then there's some stuff about politics. I don't want to give you that. Number seven is, Beloved of the Gods, King Payadasi, desires that all religions should reside everywhere, for all of them desire self-control and purity of heart. But people have various desires and various passions, and they may practice all of what they should or only a part of it. But one who receives great gifts, yet is lacking in self-control, purity of heart, gratitude, and firm devotion, such a person is mean. Beloved of the Gods speaks thus. In times of sickness, for the marriage of sons and daughters, at the birth of children, before embarking on a journey, on these and other occasions, people perform various ceremonies. Women in particular perform many vulgar and worthless ceremonies. These types of ceremonies can be performed by all means, but they bear little fruit. What does bear great fruit, however, is the ceremony of the Dharma. This involves proper behavior toward servants and employees, respect for teachers, restraint toward living beings, and generosity towards ascetics and Brahmins. These and other things constitute the ceremony of the Dharma. Therefore, a father, a son, a brother, a master, a friend, a companion, and even a neighbor should say, this is good. This is the ceremony that should be performed until its purpose is fulfilled. This I shall do. Other ceremonies are of doubtful fruit, for they may achieve their purpose or they may not. And even if they do, it is only in this world. But a ceremony of the Dharma is timeless. Even if it does not achieve its purpose in this world, it produces great merit in the next, whereas if it does achieve its purpose in this world, one gets great merit both here and there through the ceremony of the Dharma. Then I want to read you, I definitely want to, that one's about politics. King Piyadasi honors both ascetics and householders of all religions, and he honors them with gifts and honors of various kinds. But beloved of the gods does not value gifts and honors as much as he values this, that there should be growth in the essentials of all religions. Growth in essentials can be done in different ways, but all of them have as their root restraint in speech. That is, not praising one's religion or condemning the religion of others without good cause. And if there is cause for criticism, it should be done in a mild way. But it is better to honor other religions for this reason. By doing so, one's own religion benefits, and so do other religions, while doing otherwise harms one's own religion and the religions of others. Whoever praises his own religion, I want you to listen to this, whoever praises his own religion due to excessive devotion and condemns others with the thought, let me glorify my own religion, only harms his own religion. Therefore, contact between religions is good. One should listen to and respect the doctrines professed by others. Beloved of the gods, King Piyadasi desires that all should be well learned in the good doctrines of other religions. Those who are content with their own religion should be told this. King Piyadasi does not value gifts and honors as much as he values that there should be growth in the essentials of all religions, and to this end, many are working. Dharma Mahamatras, Mahamatras in charge of the women's quarters, officers in charge of outlying areas, and other such officers. And the fruit of this is that one's own religion grows, and the Dharma is an illuminated one. Let that sink in. When you condemn another's religion, you kill your own. Oh, my goodness. Then he says, indeed, beloved of the gods is deeply pained by the killing, dying, and deportation that takes place when an unconquered country is conquered. But beloved of the gods is pained even more by this, that Brahmins, ascetics, and householders of different religions who live in those countries and who are respectful to superiors, to mother and father, to elders, and who behave properly and have strong loyalty toward friends, acquaintances, companions, relatives, servants, and employees, that they are injured, killed, or separated from their loved ones. Even those who are not affected by all this suffer when they see friends, acquaintances, companions, and relatives affected. These misfortunes befall all as a result of war, and this pains, beloved of the gods. Even the forest people who live in beloved of the gods' domain are entreated and reasoned with to act properly. They're told that despite his remorse, beloved of the gods has the power to punish them if necessary, so that they should be ashamed of their wrong and not be killed. Truly, beloved of the gods desires non-injury, restraint, and impartiality to all beings, even where wrong has been done. And then, number 14, beloved of the gods, King Piyadasi has these Dharma edicts written in brief, in medium length, and in extended form. Not all of them occur everywhere, for my domain is vast, but much has been written, and I will have still more written. That's the 14 original edicts of King Ashoka that exist to this very day. Not observed to this very day, but exists to this very day. And I said, as soon as he died, his sons tore the place apart. Now, Ashoka, in his lifetime, sent Theravadan missionaries to all corners of the world. And their effect was tremendous. We'll take a brief break for station identification, and we shall return, and I'm going to tell you read to you a most remarkable document that came to Earth just a few years ago. So join us.
You are listening to the LMC Radio Network, whose art and information may be found on its webcast shows. The LMC Radio Network is a community radio alliance of metaphysical, spiritual, inspirational, and political justice broadcasters spanning a wide range of topics. Tune in Sundays for the Lucky Mojo Hoodoo Rootwork Hour, hosted by Catherine Ironwood and Conjurman Ali. It features panel discussions on traditional African-American hoodoo spellcasting with members of the Association of Independent Readers and Rootworkers, plus free readings and magical rootwork advice for live call-in clients. the longest-running Conjure show in the universe, it may be heard from 3 o'clock to 4:30 Pacific Time, Sunday afternoons. On Mondays, get ready for Candelo's Corner, starring Candelo Cambisa. This is the meeting place for all esoteric traditions. Candelo brings his insight as a Polero and eclectic spiritualist to his interviews with peers in Afro-Caribbean lineages, as well as representatives of numerous other spiritualities and religions. You can hear Candelo's Corner Monday evenings from 5 to 7 Pacific Time. Tuesdays feature two wonderful shows to suit your taste. On the Crystal Silence League Hour, John St. Germain provides spiritual guidance and tips on the practical use of crystals and crystal balls. His show starts at 5 p.m. Pacific Time and lasts for 1 hour. Next is In the Streets with Beverly Smith. Beverly provides up-to-the-minute reports on civil and social rights issues. Her one-hour show airs on Tuesday evenings at 6 p.m. Pacific Time. On Wednesday nights, Kai Armand broadcasts On Sacred Ground, a tapestry of our times comprising history, ethnography, and shamanism, featuring the voices of the land and the deceased, aided by scholars, spirit workers, and environmentalists. Kai's show airs from 5 to 7 Pacific Time. On Thursdays, it's the Now You Know Show with Professor Porterfield. In a variety show laced with country wit and biblical wisdom, the professor shares his knowledge of roots, delivers the lucky numbers, and explores the secrets of scriptural sorcery. From 6 to 7:30 p.m. Pacific Time, there's no end to the surprises. And on Saturday nights, come out and join Liquid Libations. Andrea Weston hosts this informal sharing and showcasing of poetry, short stories, and spoken word performances contributed by novices and professional wordsmiths. Call in and read your work. Liquid Libations may be heard on Saturday nights from 5 to 7 p.m. Pacific Time. All shows on the LMC Radio Network are sponsored by the Lucky Mojo Curio Company, located in Forestville, California, and online at luckymojo.com. Add 3 hours for Eastern, tax and license may apply, train departure times and Burma shape signs subject to change without notice. LMC.
Hello, and we're back. King Ashoka, who spread Buddhism through the world through a diaspora of missionaries sent everywhere. If you look in the history books of his missionary system, and look at maps of it, you'll see that missionaries went through Burma, Sri Lanka. Sri Lanka is the Sri Lanka and Burma are the current mainstays, the capitals of modern Theravada Buddhism. And Sri Lanka dates really from King Ashoka, as is Burma, or Myanmar, as it's known now. In Sri Lanka, the Sri Lankan bhikshus actually wrote down for the first time the entire Pali Canon. They wrote them on palm leaves, and some of those palm leaves still exist. They're very fragile, you know, and they're under glass and preserved in monasteries, but that's the first time that the Pali Canon was actually written down. By then, before then, it was passed down through oral tradition. Different groups of monks, hundreds of them, would memorize parts of it, and they would get together and preserve it. We then see it spread through Alexandria, Antioch, Athens, Greece, and Italy, through Judea and the Middle East. We see how it spreads through Central Asia, Western India, Southern India, through the Tarim Basin, basically throughout the world. Did it make it to America? No, not until much later. But over the Himalayas into China, from China to Japan, and the rest of there is history. Now, the missionaries that went to Greece have a very special interest, because understand that they went to Greece about 230 BC. This was at the height of Hellenistic Greece. This was at the heyday of Hellenistic Greek thought. And why do we find this interesting? Well, because I'm going to turn attention to the works of Philo of Alexandria, or Philo Judaeus, who was a Jewish religious instructor who was born in Alexandria, Egypt, who lived between the years of 20 BC and 40 AD. Philo is interesting because his brother, maybe the Alexander who's mentioned in Acts 4, verse 6. So Philo lived during the birth and subsequent crucifixion of Jesus. The works of Philo provide firsthand information of Jewish religious practices, customs, and beliefs that are mentioned in the Gospels in the book of Hebrews. Now, his works contain direct references to the Son of God, the Word, sheep with no shepherd, fishermen letting down their nets, the rich man and his treasure, the woman taken in adultery, rising up in the air to be the Lord forever, and being tested like gold by the fire. These are references that are unrelated to the references in the Gospel. The works of Philo deal with allegorical interpretations of the Decalogue, special laws, questions and answers on Genesis. And one chapter that was discovered by Buddhist scholars in the British Museum is called On the Contemplative Life. Understand, this was written very likely during the lifetime of Christ, during the tail end of the Hellenistic period, and that these people that we're about to describe had been living there probably since 200 BC. Well, not these particular people, but these are descendants of Ashoka's missionaries. On the contemplative life or suppliance, and one, having mentioned the Essenes, now the Essenes were descendants of Hindus, by the way, who in all respects selected for their admiration and for their especial adoption of the practical course of life, and who excel in all, or what perhaps may be a less unpopular and invidious thing to say in most all of its parts, I will now proceed in the regular order of my subject to speak of those who have embraced the speculative life, and I will say what appears to be me to be the desirable to be said on the subject, not drawing any fictitious statements from my own head for the sake of improving the appearance of that side of the question which nearly all poets and essayists are much accustomed to do in the scarcity of good actions to extol. This is a long sentence, but with the greatest simplicity, adhering strictly to the truth itself, to which I know well that even the most eloquent men do not keep close in their speeches. Nevertheless, we must make the endeavor and labor to attain to this virtue, for it is not right that the greatest of the virtue of the men should be a cause of silence to those who do not think it right that anything which is creditable should be suppressed in silence. But the deliberate intention of the philosopher is at once displayed from the appellation given to them, for with strict regard to etymology, they are called therapeutae and therapeutrides, from therapeuta, to heal. That's not true. That was a scholarly error. Therapeutae, Theravada, therapeutae, Theravada. Either because they possess an art of medicine more excellent than that in general use in follies, in cities, for that only heals bodies, but the other heals souls, which are under the mastery of terrible and almost incurable diseases, which pleasures and appetites, fears and griefs, and covetousness, and the living God, who is superior to the good and more simple than the one and more ancient than the unit, with whom, however, I'm sorry about this style, but, you know, this guy wrote, 40 A.D., with whom, however, there is but one of those who profess piety. What can we possibly compare? Can we compare those who honor the elements, earth, water, air, and fire, to whom different nations have given different names, calling fire Hephaestus, I imagine because of its kindling? The Greek is expasis, as is Ephesios, were also derived from apotome, being akin to a few, and the air Hera, I imagine because of it being raised up. The Greek word, I'm going to skip all that. He describes the lifestyle of the therapeutae. Let me go down. Lord God, he describes how the Romans live, how they eat until they puke. Oh my gosh, I should have looked at this before. Now, this class of person may be met with in many places, but it, for it is fitting that both Greece and the country of the barbarians should partake of whatever is perfectly good. And there is the greatest number of such men in Egypt, for in every one of the districts, or nomi, as they are called, and especially around Alexandria, and from all quarters, those who are the best of these therapeutae proceed on their pilgrimage to some most suitable place, as if it were their country, which is beyond the Mareotic Lake, lying in a somewhat level plain, a little raised above the rest, being suitable for their purpose by reason of its safety and also of the fine temperature of the air. For the houses built in the fields and the villages which surround it on all sides give it safety, and the admirable temperature of the air proceed from the continual breezes which come from the lake which falls into the sea, and also from the sea itself in the neighborhood, the breezes from the sea being light, and those which proceed from the lake giving shelter in respect to the two things most important to be provided against, the heat of the sun and the cold from the open air. And they did not live near to one another as men do in cities, for immediate neighborhood to others would be a troublesome and unpleasant thing to men who have conceived an admiration for and have determined to devote themselves to solitude. And on the other hand, they did not live very far from one another on account of the fellowship which they desire to cultivate, and because of the desirableness of being able to assist one another if they should be attacked by robbers. And in every house there is a sacred shrine, which is called the holy place, and the monastery in which they retire by themselves and perform all the mysteries of a holy life, bringing in nothing, neither meat nor drink nor anything else which is indispensable towards supplying the necessities of the body, but studying in that place the laws and the sacred oracles of God enunciated by the holy prophets and hymns and psalms and all kinds of other things, by reason of which knowledge and piety are increased and brought to perfection. Therefore they always retain an imperishable recollection of God, so that not even in their dreams is there any other object ever presented to their eyes except the beauty of the divine virtues and of divine power. Therefore many persons speak in their sleep, divulging and publishing the celebrated doctrines of the sacred philosophy, and they are accustomed to pray twice every day, at morning and at evening, when the sun is rising, entreating God that the happiness of the coming day may be real happiness, so that their minds may be filled with heavenly light, and when the sun is setting they pray that their soul, being entirely lightened and relieved of the burden of the outward senses and of the appropriate object of these outward senses, may be able to trace out truth existing in its own consistory and counsel chamber. And when interval between mornings and evenings is by them devoted wholly to meditation on and to practice of virtue, for they take up the sacred scriptures and philosophize concerning them, investigating the allegories of their national philosophy, since they look upon their literal expressions as symbols of some secret meaning of nature, intended to be conveyed in those figurative expressions. They also have writings of ancient men, who, having been the founders of one sect or another, have left behind them many memorials of the allegorical system of writings and explanations, whom they take as a kind of model, and imitate the general fashion of their sect, so that they do not occupy themselves solely in contemplation, but they likewise compose psalms and hymns to God in every kind of meter and melody imaginable, which they of necessity arrange in more dignified rhythm. Therefore, during 6 days, each of these individuals, retiring into solitude by himself, philosophizes by himself in one place, one of the places called monasteries, never going outside the threshold of the outer court, and indeed never even looking out. But on the 7th day, they will all come together as if to meet in a sacred assembly, and they sit down in an order according to their ages with all becoming gravity, keeping their hands inside their garments, having their right hand between their chest and their dress, which, if you've ever seen bhikkhus, they do that to this day. They put their hand in the namaste, and the left hand down by their side, close to their flank. And then the eldest of them, who has the most profound learning in their doctrines, comes forward and speaks with steadfast look and with steadfast voice, with great powers of reasoning and great prudence, not making an exhibition of his oratorical powers like the rhetoricians of old or the sophists of the present day, but investigating with great pains and explaining with minute accuracy the precise meanings of the laws, which sits, not indeed at the tips of their ears, but penetrates through their hearing into the soul and remains there lastingly, and all the rest listen in silence to the praises which he bestows upon the law, showing their assent only by nods of the head or the eager look of the eyes. And this common holy place to which they all come together on the 7th day is a twofold circuit, being separated partly into the apartment of the men and partly into a chamber for the women. For women also, in accordance with the usual fashion there, form a part of the audience, having the same feelings of admiration as the men, and having adopted the same sect with equal deliberation and decision. And the wall which is between the houses rises from the ground 3 or 4 cubits upward, like a battlement, and the upper portion rises upward to the roof without any opening on 2 accounts. First of all, in order that the modesty which is so becoming to the female sex may be preserved, and secondly, that the woman may be easily able to comprehend what is said being seated within earshot, since there is then nothing which can possibly intercept the voice of him who is speaking. Now, it talks about some other things, and this is very telling right here. And this expounders of the law, having first of all laid down temperance as a sort of foundation for the soul to rest upon, proceed to build upon other virtues of this foundation, and no one of them may take any meat or drink before the setting of the sun, since they judge that the work of philosophizing is one which is worthy of the light, but that the care of the necessities of the body is suitable only to darkness, on which account they appropriate the day to the one occupation, and a brief portion of the night to the other. And some men in whom there is implanted a more fervent desire of knowledge can endure to cherish a recollection of their food for 3 days without even tasting it. And some men are so delighted and enjoy themselves so exceedingly when regaled by wisdom which supplies them with her doctrine in all possible wealth and abundance, that they can even hold out twice as great a length of time, and will scarcely at the end of 6 days taste even necessary food, being accustomed, as they say, that grasshoppers are to feed on air. In short, they practice entire simplicity, looking upon falsehood as the foundation of pride, but truth as the origin of simplicity, and upon truth and falsehood as standing in the light of fountains, for from falsehood proceeds every variety of evil and wickedness, and from truth there flows every imaginable abundance of good thing, both human and divine. I could go on. There's a lot here. Man, if you want to go online and look at this for yourself, he contrasts it with the way the Greeks and Italians live. Basically, he describes an orgy. He talks about the way the extravagance of the Italians with both Greeks and barbarians emulate. And he describes an orgy. He talks about people unkempt long hair, eating until they vomit, engaging in gorging themselves like cormorants devour all the delicacies so completely that they gnaw even the bones, which some left half devoured after all they contained has been torn to pieces and spoiled. And when they're completely tired with eating, having their bellies filled up to their very throats, but their desires still unsatisfied, being fatigued with eating, they purge themselves and then start eating again. So he's comparing this type of life with the life of the Theraputte or the Theravada. When this document was found, it was spread among the Buddhist community, and it was immediately recognized as descendants several hundred years later of the missionaries that were sent out by King Ashoka. Now, what became of Ashoka? Well, he ruled for many years, 36 years. He died an old man. He passed on his kingdom to his 6 sons, who immediately started to fight over the kingdom. They went to war, they amassed a military, and they destroyed it. Now, the question we have to ask ourselves is, how come that never happened again? He started a tradition of Sangha-approved rulers, however, that continued in Asia to this day. There are many, many nations in Thailand among them who work closely with the Sanghas. Thailand, for instance, the king of Thailand is a secular and spiritual ruler, but it's not like Ashoka. It's not like Ashoka's day. And so we have to ask ourselves a very important question. Is it possible to govern a nation without force? Ashoka did have prisons. He did have punishment for crimes, but he didn't have capital punishment. No one was put to death. People weren't put into jail for minor offenses. People were given He had vast numbers of officials who looked at a person's situation. There were no Jean Valjeans. Nobody was sentenced to life in prison for stealing a loaf of bread. People weren't put in prison for political reasons. People weren't put into prison because of who they were. People weren't fined, as we are, just to make money. People are pulled over and given tickets to raise money. Every aspect of Ashoka's rule was based on justice and on kindness and on compassion. So we have to ask ourselves, could such a thing happen today? You know, we're talking about 300 BC. These people were, by modern standards, barbarians. You know, look at history. These people were barbarians by modern standards. We pride ourselves on being civilized. You know, but have we really advanced as human beings? Have we really? I'm not going to answer it. I'm just asking you. As we move upon on our journey toward this, we know that the Buddha's teachings can be looked at either simply or they can be looked upon very complexly, because there are two principles in Buddha's teaching: the Four Noble Truths and the Noble Eightfold Path. And the Four Noble Truths covers doctrine. And the primary response that the Fourfold Noble Truth elicits is understanding. And the Eightfold Noble Path covers discipline, in the very broadest sense of what that word means. And the primary response it calls for is practice. So you have two approaches to Buddhism: understanding and practice. That's what's required. You understand it and you practice it. You have to understand the Four Noble Truths and you have to practice the Noble Eightfold Path. So in the structure of these teachings, the two principles lock together, because the Eightfold Noble Path is mentioned in the Four Noble Truths, and the Four Noble Truths are mentioned and evoked in the Eightfold Path. They're interlocked. It's an indivisible unity, and this unity, this interlocked system, is called the Dhamma Vinaya, the doctrine and discipline, or if you want to put it in brief, the Dharma. The internal unity of this is guaranteed because of that interlocked system, and in fact, the first factor of the Noble Eightfold Path is called right view, and right view is understanding the Four Noble Truths. There you go. First thing, understand the Four Noble Truths. That's your first step. You got that? Boom, you're on the path. That's your first step on the path. So these two principles penetrate and include one another. There's the formula of the Four Noble Truths, which contain the Eightfold Noble Path. And the Eightfold Noble Path, the very first step, is understanding the Four Noble Truths. You don't have to do them in order. So given this unity, it would be pointless to pose the question which of the two aspects has greater value, the doctrine or the path. But if you did risk that question, the answer would have to be the path. And the path claims primacy because it's precisely the path that brings the teachings to life. You can have an intellectual understanding of the truths, but unless you walk the path, it's not going to come to life for you. The path translates the Dharma from a collection of abstract formulas into a disclosure of the path. It was the discovery of the path that made the Buddha a Sammasambuddha, a teaching Buddha, the master Buddha. Next week we're going to look at the Eightfold Noble Path step by step. We're going to examine it and discuss it exhaustively, and we're going to ask a lot of questions along the way. Keep your eye out on the political statement, the political race. You know, have a good laugh at it while you can, man. We're standing at the threshold of Armageddon, I think. So, you know, let's go out with a bang as we walk the Eightfold Noble Path. Maybe we'll make it to step number four before the end is near. This has been John St. Germain, LMC Radio Network, Crystal Silence League Hour. See you next week. I love you all. Good night.